Today's program is brought to you by Whole Foods Market, a dynamic leader in the quality food business, a mission-driven company that aims to set the standards of excellence for food retailers. For more information, visit wholefoodsmarket.com.
I'm Erica Wides, host of Let's Get Real, the cooking show about finding, preparing, and eating food. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
All right. Thank you so much for tuning in once again to the Heritage Radio Network. We are coming to you, as always, live from the back of Roberta's Pizza here. It's a lovely sunny day in Bushwick, Brooklyn, and you've tuned in to the Farm Report. I'm your host, Erin Fairbanks, and today we are on the line with Nicolette Han Nyman. Nicolette is a beef farmer, an advocate, and author, and today we're going to be talking about her new book, Defending Beef, the Case for Sustainable Meat Production. Nicolette, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Well, so I want to get the controversial stuff out of the way right up top. What is a vegetarian environmental lawyer doing, you know, writing about a beef?
Well, I probably would not have transitioned into the field of raising cattle, except for that I got married to Bill Nyman, who's the founder of Nyman Ranch, which is a network of farms and ranches around the country that use traditional animal husbandry practices and basically have their animals on grass, essentially. And when I married Bill, I had just left working for Bobby Kennedy Jr. in New York, actually, lived there for 5 years, and I was the senior attorney for the Waterkeeper Alliance. And during that time, I worked full-time on the issue of livestock pollution, and I had met the farmers and ranchers of the Nyman Ranch Network and also Bill Nyman, the founder of the company, because we were visiting their farms and ranches a lot and using them as an example of the right way to do things. So I was already kind of, predisposed to having a favorable opinion of Bill when I first met him, because I really admired what he was doing with helping all these wonderful farms and ranches around the country get their products to market. So I moved out here when we got married. We're in Northern California, north of San Francisco. I moved from Manhattan, and I still, as a vegetarian and as an environmental lawyer, I still didn't think I would be likely to enter the profession of cattle ranching at that point. But I really got super interested in what was happening here, you know, in my midst. And so I was living on the ranch, and even though I was already licensed to practice law in California, and I thought I'd probably begin working as an environmental lawyer here, I actually just started spending more and more time working on the ranch and decided to do that instead. So that was 11 years ago. So for the last 11 years, I've been directly involved in raising cattle every day.
So I think folks out there may be wondering, why exactly is it that beef is in need of defending? What prompted this kind of manifesto in defense of beef?
Well, I think it started, you know, in my book, I sort of trace it back to around 1970 when, you know, there was really this birth of the environmental movement. And at the same time, there was an increasing consciousness about the importance of food production as part of the environment. And, you know, you had books like Diet for a Small Planet that really said, that really argued very strongly that there weren't enough resources in the world to raise meat, and that if we were going to feed the world, we needed to transition away from meat. And beef, in that book, as well as in many subsequent books, was pointed to as kind of the worst offender. And so, you know, that's been several decades now, and it's really become, in my view, I worked for environmental nonprofits for several years, and I've been kind of involved in environmental causes my whole life. And, you know, I can't tell you how many times I have heard that idea that beef are, you know, the most problematic from an environmental standpoint, and then on the human health side, you know, that it's the least healthy food you could possibly eat, you know. So I really felt it needs defending.
Well, lots of great kind of content in the book, and I'm definitely encourage listeners to buy their own copy. Today I want to focus on the third chapter, which talks about water. And can you give us, you know, you mentioned obviously that you were focused on livestock through your work at the Waterkeeper Alliance. Why is the Waterkeeper Alliance an organization that's engaged with livestock producers? What's the link between livestock production and water?
Yeah, well, the water issue is a very important one, and my expertise in that actually goes back even before I was hired by Waterkeeper Alliance. I was working for National Wildlife Federation as an environmental lawyer, and my work was mostly focused on water protection there as well. When I came to Waterkeeper, Bobby Kennedy had already been, he was very frustrated by what he was seeing around the country, lots and lots of pollution, water pollution especially, that was directly attributable to concentrated livestock and poultry and dairy operations, and he really didn't feel that any of the major environmental groups, and certainly no governmental agencies, were doing much to address the problem. So he really felt this was a major unmet need in the environmental world, and the reason, you know, that, and I began visiting, as soon as I started working for him, I began visiting a lot of these facilities and a lot of these communities that have these concentrated animal operations, and the reason is essentially you have many, many animals, far more, I mean, just to give you an example, let's say a traditional chicken flock in, let's say, 1900 in the United States, almost every single farm in the United States had chickens in 1900, so they were just dispersed. In fact, they were really common in urban areas as well. A large percentage of the chickens in the United States in 1900 were in urban areas. But they were kind of everywhere, and they were in very small flocks. So a typical flock might have a dozen or 20 chickens. Now, fast forward that to about the middle of the 20th century when they began to become, you know, very concentrated, very large operations. And today, a typical operation for laying hens may have over a million chickens in it, a million hens, and a typical operation for meat chickens might have about 70,000 birds in it. So if you just think about the scale, you know, the sort of exponential increase in the number of animals, it immediately raises, you know, the specter of dramatic environmental impacts, because you have so much feed that is being transported to those operations, and then so much manure that is coming out the back sides of those. And it's literally impossible to deal in an environmentally sound way with that much waste.
Well, so you're essentially creating, for me, I feel like the thing that makes it clearest is to think of like the confined animal feeding operation as a city with a population of, you know, 20,000 or 15,000 or 100,000 or whatever it may be. Especially when you're looking at beef cattle, you know, they're obviously like by volume much larger than humans. And if you can think about the structure, infrastructure that's set up to deal with our waste, I think it doesn't take too long to get to what's happening with the waste products for these animals. So,
I want to interrupt for just a second.
In.
There's a really important distinction that I talk about in a lot of detail in my book between the way beef cattle are raised and the way other species are raised. And although dairy cattle are often confined, in fact, the majority of the United States now are in confinement buildings, that is not true for beef cattle. There are essentially no beef cattle that are raised in buildings in anywhere in the world. They're really raised outdoors still. So that's a very important distinction, both environmentally and from an animal welfare perspective. So as I argue in the book, even sort of the worst, you know, most offensive giant feedlot in Texas with 100,000 cattle in it, in my view, is a far less, is much less of a concern, especially from an animal welfare perspective, but also from an environmental perspective, because the manure is not liquefied. It is treated as a solid, and it is there. I explained it in quite a bit of detail in the book, but there are far less risks to the environment from that kind of a setup. So I just want to, you know, note that I actually view the poultry and the pig and the dairy structure, the way those are raised, as far more environmentally problematic than beef. And that's one of the myths I dispel in the book.
And it's because you can't raise beef cattle in the same type of confinement arrangement? Or, you know, why is that?
It could be done,
right.
But it's not economical, so it isn't done. Just like goats and sheep are raised outdoors, basically those are grazing animals. And, it, you know, it's not, you know, because cattle ranchers are so much nicer people than dairy farmers or something like that. It's really just about the economics. It just makes a great deal more sense to have the animals actually out on grass grazing. All of the mother cows in this country that are raised for beef are on grass. All of the bulls, all of the calves. And only when they reach a certain level of maturity do they even go into a feedlot. And some don't ever do that. So there's an enormous amount of beef cattle that are on grass. You know, a large percentage are always on grass, even when they're not raised totally for grass-fed beef. And of those that then do go to a feedlot, they still spend a large portion of their lives on grass. And then again, when they go to a feedlot, they're still outdoors in a relatively, comparatively uncrowded environment. When you compare that, again, to chickens, pigs, dairy cows, et cetera. So it's just, you know, it's just, to me, that's a very important distinction.
So can you help us paint a picture? So it, like a feedlot, the transition from the calves being like out on grass, and then at a certain point they come onto a feedlot, and why is that? Like, what at what point do you go from point A to point B?
Well, the typical, you know, beef that's raised in the United States today, and it is, again, it's important to distinguish what geography you're talking about. This is kind of a uniquely American system. There are some other parts of the world where feedlots are used, but the norm the world over actually is to have the cattle entirely on grass. And I kind of talk about that in detail in the book as well. But looking just at the United States, so if you look at the U.S., at a certain age, it's typically around a year. There is a portion of calves that go into feedlots, but that's only about 25 to 30% of the cattle go into feedlots as calves, which is a practice I strongly reject and think is not acceptable at all. But more typically, cattle will go into feedlots when they're what they call yearlings, you know, when they're around a year of age. And they're put there basically because when you're trying to get the animal to the sort of the fatter body condition and the, you know, the bigger weight and more intramuscular fat, you can do that more easily and faster and year round if you feed them grain. And it's the easiest way to do that in terms of, you know, just sort of logistically the easiest way to do that is to have the animals confined and to bring the grain to them. So, you know, in my view, there is nothing inherently wrong with feeding some grain to cattle. Our own cattle that we raise are totally grass-fed, but I think there is a time and a place for some grain feeding in certain geographies especially. But the problem is the idea has really been taken to an extreme, you know, in the modern feedlot. You have, you know, huge numbers of animals. You have, again, often they're brought in there too young, and they're fed a very high energy ration when really they should still be grazing, especially when they're at a younger age. And that can lead to health problems, et cetera. So there are a number of animal husbandry reasons not to do that, and from an environmental standpoint, it's problematic because the crops that are raised to feed to cattle and feedlots are extremely environmentally damaging.
Yeah, well, that's where I wanted to kind of go next is, you know, kind of talking about the conversation around water, and one of the spaces that at beef, I think, stands out as far as, like, getting a bad rap is the statistics that are always put out there that, you know, it's such a, that the beef production requires such a high volume of water that's completely unsustainable. And you hear these kind of crazy facts and figures, and you see them repeated in a bunch of places. And I think one of the most interesting, you know, components of your book was where you kind of took us through what all is, like, included or not included in that. And I want to tuck into that, but we have to take just a short station break. So hang tight. Okay. When we get back, we will tread into those waters, so to speak.
You are listening to It's Cold and Beautiful by Magical Mistakes.
Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Are you a locavore? Our Northeast regional forager for Whole Foods Market sure is. She spends her time traveling around the New York City metro area sourcing the best new or interesting artisanal and handcrafted local products for our purchasing teams at the local store level. Part of our commitment to our local suppliers includes assisting them with the process of getting their products sold at our stores. Whether it's suggesting packaging designs, pricing, or distribution methods, she's helping some of the area's best new products reach savvy shoppers at Whole Foods Market stores. Today, New York. Tomorrow, the world. For more information, visit WholeFoodsMarket.com.
Hey, my name is Betsy Andrews, executive editor of Severa Magazine, and I am hanging out at the coolest, most delicious place in the world, HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
All right, we are on the line with Nicolette Han Nyman talking about her new book, Defending Beef, The Case for Sustainable Meat Production. So talking about water, you know, in, what is it, I'm on page 85 here, you state that a well-managed grazing does not cause water pollution and that the overall effect of grazing cattle as part of a food system is a net positive for water in terms of both quantity and quality.
Yes.
Can you give it, fill us in on some of the details there? So I think obviously in the first section of the show, if people are just tuning in, you know, you made the distinction between the way beef cattle are raised in comparison to dairy animals or the poultry industry or the pork industry. So why is it that beef is still kind of like lumped in this negative environmental space? And is there, you know, I'm assuming that there are people who are like offenders as it relates to kind of water quality, but as like a general assumption or in the volume of production, that's not an issue? Or just break it down for us, because I'm like a little unclear.
Well, okay, there are a couple of major issues. I actually, in the water chapter, I sort of break it down into quantity and quality concerns. And when you work in, you know, water quality protection, as I did as an environmental lawyer for several years, you're always looking at those two issues kind of distinctly. You know, is something causing pollution or is it wasting the water? So that's the quantity versus quality. So let's look for just a second at the quantity issue, because you mentioned that before the break. It gets repeatedly stated, you know, on websites and blogs and stuff all the time that beef is this tremendous outlier when it comes to water consumption. And the reason for that is because you can, in fact, create a number that seems very large of the amount of water per pound of beef. If you look at a worst-case scenario, you could probably do that with just about any food. And what I cite in the, I go through quite a bit of the research in my book, and I cite what I think is the most credible study that's ever been done on this issue, really trying to quantify a typical pound of beef, how much water is required in the entire phase of production. And that's from University of California at Davis.
Right.
Which is an excellent school, and they came up with a figure for a typical pound of beef. That's an incredibly important distinction. Not a worst-case scenario, but a typical pound of beef in the United States today. And they found that the water usage is just a little bit higher than what a pound of rice takes. Now, rice is a fairly water-intensive food as well. So is coffee, chocolate, sugar, avocados, almonds, walnuts.
It's like all my favorite stuff.
There are a lot of water-intensive foods. There are many wonderful, delicious water-intensive foods, and I think it's important to be mindful about those issues. But the suggestion that you hear over and over again, that beef is some enormous guzzler of water and it's a tremendous outlier, that's just not true. Okay, so that's the first thing. The second thing is, in terms of water quality, how much water pollution does something cause? Beef production is incredibly variable depending on how it's done. So just like with almost any other human activity, if it's done well, it'll have a totally different impact than if it's done badly. And there are, you know, lots of people will claim that, you know, it causes, beef production causes erosion or causes, you know, water pollution. But in reality, a well-managed grazing operation is probably one of the most protective uses of land, human uses of land, in terms of water, because you will keep a very dense vegetative cover, which protects the soil. It keeps it in place, and it also creates a below-ground environment that's like a sponge, and it holds the water. So there's been very good research on this around the world showing that the total annual rainfall is much less important in an area than how, you know, the condition of the soil, the health of the soil. And when you have healthy soil, you will make, you know, you will keep that water in the environment, and that's actually a lot more important. So drought-stricken regions and water-stressed regions that have well-managed grazing will actually be very well served by that. And it's actually more protective of water than most other forms of agriculture and human uses. So that's a really, really important thing for people to understand.
What? Why is it? I mean, where does this come from? Like, why is it that beef has been the target, do you think?
Well, I kind of trace the history of a little bit in defending beef, but I really think it's just a series of, you know, sort of books and, you know, advocacy pieces that have, I read the book Beyond Beef by Jeremy Rifkin that he wrote, I think, about 15 years ago or so. I read it about 10 years ago. And, you know, it basically says that literally every bad thing on the planet is because of cattle. You know, his wife is a vegan, and then he became a vegan, I think, at some point. And people love to say that. I mean, it makes a great story. And I think the reason why beef has been so, you know, kind of this favorite target of a lot of sensational journalism is because it was, up until just a couple years ago, it was the most consumed meat in the United States.
Right.
And it was always considered the most desirable. You know, because beef has always been more expensive than other meats, and it is a luxury meat in some parts of the world where they don't have enough grazing area to raise it. So there's something really appealing about making the case that it's a horrible thing that, you know, is the cause of all evils. And especially because in the United States, you know, we had the iconic hamburger. I mean, you know, it's just something very sexy about knocking it off its throne.
Yeah, I would say, like, in a weird way, it's like, I don't know, like anti-American, but it feels very, the conversation feels very like bandwagon-y. And I think that's a thing you see in media a lot. And it's always something that, you know, you have to be careful where you're repeating kind of like facts and figures. And especially when you're looking at agriculture production, there's so many different kind of systems at play that I think it's hard. Honestly, it's like hard for consumers. It's hard for people in the media to keep up on all of those, you know, moving parts. So, you know, it's great that like I feel like it's great that you put out this resource for folks. And I want to ask you, you know, when we think about the beef industry, for me, I always think about the relationship between dairy animals and meat animals, and the fact that kind of, you know, biologically, even if you're a dairy breed, if you're a male, like, you don't fit into that system. Did you look into at all kind of the overlap of the dairy system and the beef system and where those two kind of play nice with each other, or is there like a system that like is set up for the male dairy animals that is similarly environmentally beneficial to the beef production systems that you outline?
Well, most people, I've met quite a few vegetarians over the years that did not understand, the real role of eggling hens and dairy cattle in the food system. So it might be important just to make sure that's clear to people that are listening. All dairy cows end up in the beef stream. In fact, up until a few decades ago, about 50% of U.S. beef came from dairy cattle. That number is quite a bit lower today because we actually have far fewer dairy cattle in the country today than we did 100 years ago or 50 years ago. And the reason for that is because of various things that have made the per animal production much higher. But in any event, there's a big overlap between the beef industry and the dairy industry because all dairy cows end up as beef. Now, you mentioned the dairy calves, the male calves, not only all end up as meat, they all end up as meat, but the ones that are males have no role in a dairy, right? So they either become veal, which is the typical approach that's done in Europe, for example, but there's not nearly as much veal consumption in the U.S., so there are various different things that are done with male dairy calves, and some are raised to maturity and sold as meat. And I have no objection to that, but unfortunately, in fact, I think that's great, but unfortunately, in a lot of cases, those male dairy calves, are directly sent to a feedlot. That is a situation where you have calves that are literally never on grass. Those are not beef calves. All beef calves are on grass. But those dairy calves sometimes go directly to a feedlot, which is really unfortunate. So anyway, there's a lot of overlap. And, my argument in the book is that really all cattle, both dairy cattle and beef cattle, should be on grass to the greatest extent possible. It creates better, healthier food. It creates better, health for the animals, and it's definitely better from an ecological standpoint.
And as a consumer, when I'm, getting a hamburger at kind of the local pub, I have no way to tell unless the proprietor lets me know, whether it's a dairy cow that this hamburger came from or whether it was a beef cattle. And I think, too, that is like when you get into kind of other concerns around labeling and production line and transparency. But I want to, highlight that there's a distinction there.
Yeah. And actually, there's absolutely nothing wrong with beef from dairy cattle. But the problem is that when you use the beef from conventionally raised dairy cows, okay, I'm not talking about the organic dairy cows. That's a whole different set of issues. But when conventional dairy cows, which is the majority of the dairy herd in the United States, there's very little restriction on what they can be fed. And there's quite a lot of, things that are added to the feed and so forth that people might not want in their food chain. So that's the trouble, and in Europe where you had an enormous number of mad cow disease cases, there's almost none of it in the United States. The total number of dairy or cattle in the United States had mad cow disease is something like 5 or 7, I think. So it's tiny. But in Europe, they had a huge problem with it, and it was mostly from dairy cattle because those are the ones that are fed a lot of feeds. They're not grazing nearly as much, and mad cow disease is transmitted entirely through the feed. So there's a question of sort of, the purity of the food that's being created. And if you want to eat beef that I think you can be really confident doesn't have objectionable additives in the food stream, I think the best thing is to get totally grass-based beef, whether it's from dairy cows that spent their whole life on grass, which there are some, not a lot, or beef cattle that spent their entire life on grass. That way you can kind of avoid all of the concerns about feed additives and hormones and other things, because people that are raising their cattle entirely on grass don't use those things.
Don't use those things anyway. Well, obviously, we're bringing up here more questions than we're answering and making a case, I guess, for the purchasing of your book. But we are just about out of time. I wanted to touch on just like one more area that I thought was interesting. We're talking again about water usage, and one of the other areas you go into is the link between kind of water and energy use as it relates to both crop production and fertilizer production. And I'm wondering if you could just outline briefly kind of when we're talking about kind of the inputs for beef, like how we think about crop production and fertilizer. Like, I think that's the thing that doesn't pop immediately to mind, that, oh, like, these are the other areas I need to be thinking about when I'm thinking about my beef. Why is it that you chose to highlight these?
Well, actually, I think it's true for all food production. I mean, there are two aspects that are incredibly important that you just mentioned. One is sort of the environmental impact of plowing land. You know, all crop production is environmentally very problematic. I have a quote from Wes Jackson in the book where he says the single greatest damage that humans have done to the globe is by plowing it, you know. And he's a great agricultural thinker for those of your listeners who don't know who he is, but he's the founder of the Land Institute in Kansas. And, you know, plowing is just problematic. So whenever you have to raise crops to feed the animals, or even just raise crops for direct human consumption, you have to worry about these issues of erosion and soil contamination and soil loss. When you're growing those crops, it's also very typical in the United States. You know, the vast majority of crops are raised using a lot of agricultural chemicals. So there's also the concern of, you know, chemical contamination, and the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico is mostly due to crop production in the upper Midwest because of these issues, because of the chemicals and because of the erosion that it causes. So to me, this is all part of the necessity of the grass-based agricultural system that I think we need to move toward. And the reason why cattle are so important is because you can raise food, you can raise grazing animals on a grassland that you don't have to plow, you don't have to put any agricultural chemicals on it, you don't have to irrigate it, and you can essentially keep it in its natural state, and the animals do the harvesting themselves. That's actually the environmentally optimal place for food production. And so if we're doing well-raised cattle, I think they actually are among the most ecologically possible ways to raise food.
Nicolette, thank you so much. It was really a pleasure to chat with you, and I'm excited to make my way through the rest of the book. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Erin. It's been a real pleasure.
For folks out there who want to learn more, definitely check out Defending Beef, The Case for Sustainable Meat Production, available wherever fine books are sold. Definitely way more in there than we were able to touch on today. Also, lots of, I feel like, empowering information for those kind of round the dinner table conversations with your non-meat eating friends and your environmental friends, and just a great kind of toolkit for unpacking a lot of what's happening in agriculture today. So definitely check that out. This show, like all 39 of our weekly programs, is available for free. You can find us on iTunes or Stitcher Smart Radio. Definitely subscribe if you like it. That's a big help to hosts like myself. Leave a review if you have comments or questions or feedback. And I hope that you also check us out by visiting the website, www.heritageradionetwork.org. If you like what we do, we are a member-supported organization, so click that donate tab and become a member today. Thank you so much for listening, and stay tuned in.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.